You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
WrestleSpective. I am your host, Jason Mann, and on the program today for the very first time, Charles from ProWrestling.com. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thanks. ProWrestlingOnly.com.
Oh, I'm sorry. ProWrestlingOnly.com. What did I say?
ProWrestling.com.
Oh, that's my goodness. I'm a big fan of ProWrestlingOnly.com. I enjoy going very much. So, and everyone else should check it out, too. It's a great discussion. Really fun history and research going on there. A really good place to talk wrestling.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm glad to do this.
Yeah. So we are going to talk about the main events of WrestleWar 90. It is Ric Flair defending the NWA Championship against Lex Luger. This originally was supposed to be Sting. However, he was injured, I guess just 2 weeks before or so, or maybe 3 weeks or so, at the Clash of the Champions heading into this. That was sort of the big show that was going to set this up. But and with the Horsemen turning against Sting and so Lex Luger, who was a heel at the time but was U.S. champion, was kind of thrown in his place, which you had. There are sort of mixed feelings about that historically. But you chose to do this match. So what about this match stands out as worthy of discussion for you?
I think personally, well, there are a lot of things, but I'll just focus on a couple. I actually think that aside from maybe the War Games match that headlined WrestleWar 92, I think this is the best main event to headline, or the best match to headline a WCW pay-per-view of the 90s. So, and I know that's pretty high praise, and we'll get into why I feel that way, but I like talking about it from that perspective. Also, I think it's probably the last time. I mean, Ric Flair had matches after this that are definitely very good and even great, and I think he had moments of greatness, but I think this was the last time that we saw the same Ric Flair that we saw in the 1980s. So it wasn't somebody who was on a career revival for one night. I mean, by the time he got to like 1993 and the Vader match at Starrcade, Ric Flair was trying to reclaim his past glory. When he did the Steamboat match at Spring Stampede 94, they were trying to recapture the essence of their matches from 1989. This was Ric Flair in Ric Flair time. And so it holds a special place for me because I think it's the last time that we saw that version of Ric Flair.
Yeah, and there's definitely to that. I mean, kind of after this, the Sting match is kind of a disappointment when Sting ends up winning the title. Of course, there may be some extenuating circumstances there with Sting's injury. And then, you know, kind of Flair is sort of shunted in. I mean, he does win the title again in early 91, but you know, there's nothing really super memorable that he does, you know, between losing the belt and leaving for WWE. He has a pretty good run in WWE and some good stuff there. But yeah, I do think this is definitely classic Ric Flair on display the entire match. You know, not just moments of it, but you know, there. But you know, he has a dance partner here, Lex Luger, who I know there are definitely mixed feelings about Lex Luger out there. But I definitely think at this point, like, Lex Luger's really quite a very good wrestler and very impressive in his performance in this match, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think I would say from the end of 1988 to probably the middle of 1991, he didn't have bad matches on pay-per-views. And sometimes, some of them are better than others, but they were all, I think, at the very least, good. It was a pretty impressive hot streak, I think, when you look back at it. And he's a guy that I don't think he ever became a great worker. I don't think he ever had the potential to be a great worker, but I do think that he was better than he got credit for. I think he worked harder than he got credit for. I mean, this match goes 38 minutes, and I mean, they do some stuff at the beginning that's kind of slow pace, but I mean, they don't cut an easy pace for this match by any means. So, he worked hard and he held up his own. I mean, Flair was the guy carrying the match and directing it, but Luger wasn't, completely passive in his role.
I mean, he showed really great, he showed really great intensity throughout, like really engaged the crowd, really, sold a lot of Flair's offense, like his chops. Like even when, he's kind of like he's popping back up, like he's invulnerable to the pain, you still kind of feel the impact on a lot of that stuff, and he makes you, he makes you feel it. I do feel like Luger and obviously Flair does a lot of wonderful things too, but I really feel like throughout there is just something of a like Luger reminds me a little bit of like a like a 2007 or so John Cena, who's sort of like he's raw but he's physical, and he is and he's kind of getting the best out of the situation despite his limitations.
Yeah, and I mean, people love Roman Reigns right now. I don't know that Roman Reigns could do a 40-minute match at this level with anyone on the roster. And that's not, I'm not saying that as a dig at him. I'm just saying I don't think that Roman Reigns is there yet. He probably will be at some point, but I don't think he could do a match at this level on his own right now without the other two members of the Shield to carry it for him. So,
Sure.
yeah, so I mean, and Roman Reigns is someone that people are generally positive about, that they say nice things about. So I think that, I mean, he wasn't. I think maybe sometimes just because of his physique and the era in which he was, a star, it's easy to kind of lump him in the same category with like the Ultimate Warrior because they both kind of got big at the same around the same time and then both kind of faded out around the same time, but Luger was far better than that.
Yeah. And there is sort of the, I think there's sort of a bad taste because I think Luger is viewed as mediocre at best from basically, his WWF run through the late 90s into early 2001 and kind of has a little bit of the goofy promos and even though he did connect with the crowds very well and especially in WCW in the late 90s, I do feel like that version of Lex Luger, who, I've seen some arguments that even, there's some merits to that version of Lex Luger, but I do think that there's a definite, drop in quality from his early career to his later career.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, he was a guy that by and large at that point, I mean, he may have done a couple of things that were not bad, but I think by and large, by that point, he was a guy living off of the reputation of the matches that he had during the time period that we're here to talk about today.
Sure, absolutely. So WCW in 1990, it's kind it's an interesting mix of like some veterans, some of them who are past their prime, but it's definitely like you look at it and it's like, wow, this is an incredibly deep roster. I mean, there's just so many great tag teams on this card. There's the Midnight Express and the Rock and Roll Express. The Freebirds, maybe who the Freebirds, maybe definitely the Garvin Hayes combo, not the best remembered version of the Freebirds, but you're talking about 80 stars who still have some some value in everything. And you've got young up and comers, obviously Sting and Luger are well established and both are title contenders. You've got someone like Brian Pillman, you've got the Steiners. I mean, you really do have a the Road Warriors, you really do have like what seems like it should be a lot of depth, yet WCW in 1990 and even especially continuing through the next couple of years is just a real mess.
Yeah, it's amazing that, I mean, it was sad when WCW closed its doors in 2001, but it really is amazing that they lasted as long as they did. And I say that as someone who was a huge fan of the company. So when I talk about that, I'm not talking about the quality of the stuff WCW put out. In fact, I think you could say that from an in-ring point of view, for most of their existence, WCW was probably better than the WWF during the same time period, maybe all the way up until 2000 when Benoit and his three friends went to the WWF, maybe even that long. But I mean, and I'm saying that not so much to, criticize the WWF, but more just to say that, I mean, if you look at what they were doing in the ring, WCW was usually a pretty good promotion, and that was one of the best things about watching the company. The problem was, and I think this goes back to when Ted Turner purchased the company from Jim Crockett. They never actually decided what they wanted to be. They had two directions that they could have gone. They could have been a true competitor to the WWF, which would have required a lot of money and some ruthless tactics, and they would have needed to raid their roster and fight dirty and spend a lot, upgrade their production. There were a lot of things they needed to do. Or they could just focus on producing cheap original programming for TBS and, not go after the big names and not really worry so much. Maybe there wouldn't be like the same high level of popularity, but there wouldn't be the same lows because they're running a pretty conservative promotion that doesn't take a lot of chances and just tries to book well enough to do decent numbers and get by. But they can't do both. You can't try not to spend the money and do like kind of low grade production and haphazard booking and expect to compete with the WWF. And I think that I don't know that the higher ups at TBS really had an understanding of what type of investment was needed for them to really be competitive. I guess that's where I give Eric Bischoff some credit, even though, I mean, there's a lot of criticism I could throw at him too. He was at least able to make that case to the right people in the Turner organization. Hey, if we want to compete, this is what we have to do. And he was able to convince them to give him the resources to do it. But up until that, I mean, prior to that, no one was able to get that type of support from TBS itself. And that's unfortunate because, I mean, there were times when there were some really strong wrestling minds booking WCW, running the company. And they had flaws, but I mean, based on the talent they had, and even based on some of the people that they had that were making some creative decisions, there was no excuse for them to be as much of a train wreck as they were so much of the time.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I do wonder the inability to move on from Flair to a certain extent, even though Flair was still valuable and obviously, had a lot of, really did have a lot of years left, but at the same time, Flair on top wasn't having the same effect that it used to have. And there was a certain segment of the fan base that was just not going to accept anyone but Flair up there, but there was also sort of a need to move on to the next generation of stars, and obviously Sting and Luger being the two primary candidates for that.
And the problem, I think, with both of them, and I agree that they needed to find a new star, but the problem with both Sting and Luger is that NWA fans were very spoiled by the quality of the match that they would get on top every night on house shows and headlining pay-per-views. And, Sting and Luger both had their own positives, but neither was the type of guy that could give you a 30-minute, wrestling match at that level with a variety of opponents. That just wasn't who they were. And that's what I think the NWA fans wanted at that point. And so, I mean, it's kind of like a dilemma because maybe in order to grow, they needed to take that risk and piss off the Flair fans. And they managed to do that, but then they didn't do what they needed to do to grow. So it was like they took the risk, but then they didn't do anything with it. Like they were willing to piss off the loyalists and the Flair followers, but they weren't willing. They had no idea what they were going to get in return for that. Because if you're going to give that up, you got to get something bigger back.
I do wonder if the fact that Luger and Sting were both kind of like almost equal viable. I mean, I at this point, it's clearly Sting who is, in line. But, there were different points between 88 and 90 where you might think that Luger would have been the choice to succeed Flair. And I wonder if the fact that there were two viable options almost worked against WCW to a certain extent, where if it had just been like one choice between the two, if one of them had been there and one of them had not, if that would have made any difference. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I think your points are absolutely, it was going to be rough going just because, yeah, neither Luger or Sting could had the same ability to, have those great matches night in and night out that Flair did.
Yeah, and I think, it's interesting if you look at the numbers, if you compare Sting as a challenger and Luger as a challenger to each other, Luger was by far the bigger draw. They had a series. I mean, the first time that Flair and Luger feuded was in 1988, after Luger left the Horsemen. They headlined the Great American Bash and they headlined Starrcade. But people talk about that finish at the Bash in '88, where they stopped the match because Luger was bleeding and he had barely a drop of blood at all on his forehead because it was just such a weak blade job. So it's kind of legendary for that, but it actually worked in the sense that that finish led to a really strong series of houses headlined by Flair versus Luger. Like they were doing, they were outdrawing, like the WWF was running Savage versus DiBiase at the time on top, and the Flair Luger match was actually drawing more fans than that match, at least on its first go around in some cities like Philadelphia and Baltimore.
Which is impressive because that would be, close to WWF's height, obviously non-Hogan height, but still, that Savage DiBiase, that was a hot thing too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, and then even after this match, and we'll talk about the finish of this match, there's a lot you could say about the finish of this match, but it did lead to the best house show run that WCW had for a long time, all the way up until 1996 when Ric Flair versus Randy Savage became a hot issue, actually. And then, when Sting became champion, that wasn't the case. And in fairness, Sting wasn't going around the horn defending the title against Flair for the most part. And I think that might have made some of a difference. But even if you look at Sting as a challenger to Flair, like in 1988, and he didn't do bad, but it wasn't at the same level as Luger.
And there's always kind of the criticism of Sting that whenever he was on top, other than the 96, 97 Crow era where he didn't really wrestle, he never really was a business success.
Yeah, he really wasn't. And it's one of those things that I think, yes, people sometimes don't get that, but I kind of understand why they don't get that, because if you watch TV, the guy looks like a superstar. All those guys do. Sting, Luger, the Steiners. I mean, they really came across on television as superstars, and they were stars of the number two promotion in the country. It's just that that really didn't mean anything at that point, because the number two promotion wasn't really doing anything that was, that had any traction at all.
I do want to talk a little, before we get into the match, I do want to talk a little bit about the Wild Thing rap. Because I knew nothing about the Wild Thing rap until today, and it was a wonderful thing.
Are you talking about the version that opened the show?
Yes. Oh, wait a minute. Is there like a more full Wild Thing rap?
I will hook you up with that when we
Oh.
finish. Okay, there are actually two Wild Thing raps, and one is an alternate video to this. So it's an actual video that they used to hype the show, and but it's the same rap. And then there's another one that's a completely different rap and a completely different video. It even has the line in it, and this is my favorite line. Ric Flair, the champ, testament to biology, meets Sting, the dream of etymology. I love the Wrestle War rap. In fact, one of the first things I checked when I started subscribing to the network was I went to that show just to make sure that it wasn't overdubbed.
Thank goodness the original survives.
Yes.
Well,
So if you haven't done it, anyone who's listening should go listen to that rap right now.
I'm going to recite it just for people who don't want to pause and who want to get a sample of it before they enjoy the full glory. Hey, homeboy, gather around. Some serious stuff is going to go down. For the WrestleWar 90, the Kings of the Ring all come together and do the wild thing. Lex Luger, the Steiners, Nature Boy Sting, and they all be doing that wild thing. Yeah, they all be there with something to prove, brimming with intentions to bust a move. And there's a very long pause, and then there's this like, whoa, 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 wild thing kind of thing at the end.
Now,
So,
on the commercial that had that rap in it, there was actually another verse. So there is another verse, and it says,
okay.
"Paper excitement from THE. For more information, call your cable company." And then, so I think obviously they didn't need to say call your cable company if you already did and ordered the show. So I guess that's why they took that off.
Which is a nice, that's a little more than sometimes I would expect from WCW production crew.
You start a pay-per-view and you're being told to order
Yeah, exactly. So
it.
well done. So we are in Greensboro, North Carolina. Of course, the site of many a great Ric Flair moment. We have Jim Ross and Terry Funk on commentary. Terry Funk very flashy with the earring. He's got a tuxedo and he's got some sort of like corsages on his jacket. So he's very colorful. I feel like Terry Funk is like a little bit trying to do a Jesse Ventura thing.
I think so too. I mean, and Terry Funk had started doing commentary, I think, after the I Quit match, actually. He started hosting Worldwide with Chris Cruz in December sometime. Yeah, I think it was in December. And they actually had really great chemistry. I mean, and I thought he did a good job on this show too, but I think Terry Funk actually worked better with Chris Cruz than he did with Jim Ross. I think they just complemented each other just a little bit better. He had this thing where he would call Tom Zink, the Z-Man, he would call him Z-Man, like as if that was his last name. And Chris Cruz would always say, "It's the Z-Man." And he would say, "That's what I said, Z-Man." And it was this running gag. And so he would just constantly call him Z-Man and then act like he didn't know what Chris Cruz was talking about when he
There
said,
you
"It's
go.
not Z-Man, it's Z-Man."
Funk had some nice humor. There was a few times where he kind of felt lost or didn't quite seem to have like the right thing to say, but like I can definitely, obviously Terry Funk is among like the most talented people ever in wrestling. So he's gonna, you put him in almost any situation, he's gonna at least give you something. It was nice to hear him on commentary, even if there were definitely some flaws.
He's good. And yeah, I don't want to say I didn't like him with Jim Ross. I just think as good as he was with Jim Ross, he was even better with Chris Cruz. That's all.
So Luger's actually not really quite yet turned. I don't know if you can explain the sort of the circumstances of what they sort of did with Luger once Sting got injured.
They did a television taping that actually, it was actually Ric Flair's last weekend as Booker. So Ric Flair resigned as Booker 1 week before the show, because they wanted him to drop the title to Luger at the show, and he refused because he had already promised that he would do it for Sting. And he told Sting before, when he got injured, "I will, no matter what they try to do to me, I will not drop this belt until you come back." And so Flair refused and ended up losing his spot on the booking committee as a result. But anyway, the last weekend that he booked of television had the Horsemen, because at that point they were kind of selling the idea. I mean, Sting injured himself when he climbed the cage at Clash 10, but they were, when he was trying to get to Flair as part of their angle, but they were pushing the idea that the Horsemen found Sting in a parking lot and jumped him and took him out. So that was the storyline reason that he was out. And so the weekend before, Luger was out for an interview with Jim Cornette, actually. And the Horseman came out before he could even say anything and said that he was surely smart enough to avoid the same fate as Sting. And they told him he had until the end of the show to decide if he wanted to bow out of the title match with Flair, or if he wanted to you know, or if he was going to make the worst decision of his life and meet the same fate as Sting. And Luger is smirking the whole time. He's not acting like a babyface, which is great. Some continuity with his character before that. Like, he's just seems annoyed and is kind of rolling his eyes while they're talking. And, you know, he just, all he says is, "I assure you, you will have an answer by the end of the show. No, no question." And so Flair headlined the show against Brian Pillman in a really strong match, actually. But after that match, you know, Luger came out and the Horseman thought, "Oh, he's seen the light, he's seen the light." And Luger said, "I've got your answer right here," and just threw right hands at all of them. And that was how the show ended. So, yeah, Luger didn't actually turn at that point. I think he was kind of the de facto babyface, but sure. They had some, at that point, they hadn't done anything to make him different. Which I think was probably a wise move, because I think it, I mean, we'll talk about the finish again, but the finish would not have worked the way it did had they made him an instant babyface.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, Flair is in a pink robe. Woman is with him, who is in a purple dress and, I guess purple eye makeup as well. She looks incredible, which I guess is, not a surprise, but, yeah, she was quite, I would say, I don't know. I would say 1990 woman might be the most attractive woman the Horsemen were ever associated with.
Yeah. And well, I mean, I think Dark Journey was pretty attractive herself, but yeah, other than that, I mean, the competition is Baby Doll.
When was Dark Journey with the Horsemen?
And right after, Crockett purchased the UWF in 1987. She was valet for a few months that summer.
I didn't realize that. Well, there you go.
Yeah, but yeah, she's she definitely looks like the time period.
Yes.
Very, just as far as like having like the Tammy Faye makeup caked on her face, and you know, having the big kind of big bangs and all that.
Sure. It's working for me though.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Hey, I mean, everyone's got their own taste, you know.
Absolutely.
Luger is in green trunks, black knee pads, and white boots. He's the U.S. champ, as you mentioned. Flair actually has hot pink trunks and boots and blue knee pads, which actually I kind of like that combo. That wouldn't be one I would think on paper would work very well, but I actually kind of thought that worked pretty well.
It's kind of like the "it's a boy, it's a girl."
Yeah, they're both very bright. This is 1990, so everything's very bright.
Yeah.
We actually introduced Sting, though, first, as Gary Michael Capetta explains to us that tragedy befell the National Wrestling Alliance on February 6th when Sting was attacked at the hands of the Horsemen. So we have the introduction of Sting. He comes out on crutches. Capetta explains to us that he is charismatic, he is electrifying, he is Sting. And then Sting, of course, walks to the ring in the crutches, and then he gets rid of them, and he actually walks up onto the apron without the crutches, and you know, plays to the crowd, and then as Lex enters the ring, Sting leaves, so that they don't, no signs of friendship there at all, you know, and the commentators mention it's like, hey, they're not buddies, but you know, later on as Lex is wrestling, they say, well, I'm sure that Sting is, you know, rooting for Lex since he hates Flair so much, but they're not pals. Flair is billed as a 6-time champ at this point, although he actually does have a few more, but 6 times is the official number. And today, this is February 25th, 1990. It is actually Ric Flair's birthday. Although I think Ross tells me that it's Luger's birthday at first. I was a little confused because he was saying something about it being Luger's lucky day, or he felt like it was going to be Luger's lucky day. He felt like Luger was going to win. In any case, it's actually Flair's birthday. He turned 41 on this day. Luger was 31 at the time.
Yes.
And definitely, I was a little surprised that we're in Greensboro, but like no one is cheering for Flair. Like I guess I'm used to the later WCW crowd reactions where Flair's going to get just cheered in Flair country no matter what. Where like, you know, but you know, because they're I guess mostly because of Sting, but obviously Luger de facto here. You know, the fans are, you know, pretty much universally booing Flair.
I think that the shift happened with Flair probably when he returned from the WWF in 93, where he started getting the cheers no matter what in the Carolinas, because the way that I think it evolved was that he was an asshole, but he was our asshole.
Sure.
And I think that's kind of how they saw Flair.
Yeah, and I guess once, like, Hogan came in, like, probably the Carolina fans rejecting that. Like, maybe if Flair had faced another babyface in 94, you could have seen them go against Flair, but because it's Hogan, there's no way they're just going to do that.
Yeah, and I think that would have even happened if Hogan had jumped in 1987, just because in that part of the country, those fans were loyal to Crockett and did not like the WWF, I think, more than any region in the country. Yeah. They were rabid fans, especially, you know, in terms of being loyal to the NWA. So that probably would have happened at any time.
So before we get into the match, I just want to talk a little bit about, because obviously, you know, the Horsemen are the big dominant heel faction in Crockett from 85 through 88. And it is, you know, it's mostly this big, huge, successful run. And it kind of fades a little bit in 88, and Crockett starts having problems, and they have to sell to Turner. But it's this big legendary thing, but eventually it kind of stops working. So they turn Flair babyface, and he has this great, you know, this classic year of 89 where he's on his own, and he's ostensibly babyface, but he's really just kind of Ric Flair, and he's just, you know, he's this. The character is kind of like the old NWA touring champion, where he's not really either a face or a heel. He's just kind of, you know, he just sort of situational, you know. And he has, of course, the classic feud with Steamboat and the classic feud with Terry Funk. And they kind of move away from a lot of the excesses of the Crockett Horseman era with a lot of the screw jobs and all that sort of thing. And I guess I'm setting up with, now we go back to the well of the Horsemen, and they would go to the Horsemen, you know, here and there quite a bit in the 90s. What'd you kind of think of them going back to the Horsemen at this point? I mean, I guess obviously the idea was to set up the Sting Flair rivalry, and that, you know, it was a decent way to do it, but you know, it did in a way also kind of felt like we're rehashing territory that maybe we, you know, should be past.
Yeah, it was kind of a stale retread. Now, when they first came in, when Arn and Ole is actually originally going to be Arn and Tully, but when they first came in at the end of 89, when they returned from the WWF, or when Arn returned, I should say, the Horsemen were babyfaces. And there are some matches around the end of the year, in the beginning of 1990, or end of 89, beginning of 90, that really show just how much fans loved the idea of a babyface for Horsemen. Mm-hmm. So I think if they had stuck with that, it could have been fresh and it could have been something different and something cool. But believe it or not, the only reason that Ric Flair turned was because Ric Flair preferred to be a heel. And yeah, he was the booker and he was going to make it happen. And that was the only reason that he did. And I think it was a terrible decision. I mean, I know that it was his comfort zone as far as working, but it seemed like it just led to a series of unfortunate events.
Sure. Although if the plan is to transition to Sting, Flair does kind of have to be the heel in that case, right?
I don't know. I think by this point, Flair was so respected that he kind of, if you remember, I don't know if you watched, did you watch WCW in 1994?
I've seen some, but I didn't really watch it at the time.
Ric Flair was a guy who was – he didn't go too far in either direction. The key thing around the first half of the year in 94 is that he was just Ric Flair.
Right.
And if he was feuding with Vader, he was a total babyface. He was feuding with Steamboat, he was a heel. And it was maybe a little bit more subtle than some of like the classic Horseman heel stuff, but he was still a heel. But so I think to me – he could have probably transitioned to Sting, and maybe it would have carried a little bit more weight because it could have been more like a Hogan Warrior thing.
So you think they could have basically kept him as an 89 character, and they could have just transitioned as a babyface thing.
Right, where he could have been the heel for the feud, and they could have done angles where he's not doing sneak attacks in parking lots, but he is being kind of an asshole and getting in Sting's face and talking trash.
Or a little bit like the Piper Bret Hart thing, where Piper is clearly like sort of teasing being the heel and teasing being the guy, and kind of is like the, you know, the cocky older brother almost to a certain extent.
Exactly. And I even think Flair could have cheated in the match, and like, you know, he could have done all that, like pulled up and told the crowd to shut up, you know, that fat kid in the front row that pestered Flair, I think, for his entire career. You know, he still could have done all those things and it would have been fine. I just don't think that they needed to go so over the top. I don't think they needed to commit Flair to just being a heel at that point. I think he was too valuable, and they needed him to wear too many hats to just put him in one role and keep him there.
Okay, so you kind of think he's almost above that at that point.
I do.
Yeah, I can see that. That makes a lot of sense. All right, so let's talk about the match. I liked that we had like we heard the in-ring instructions with from Nick Patrick, the referee, and then like I like we get some back talk between Flair and Luger, with Flair telling Luger that he better be ready. I mean, nothing. It was nothing that was, you know, anything really that noteworthy, but I just kind of like seeing that, and I just kind of liked getting that like real nice close up and just feeling like you're part of that action. Some, you know, the WCW production gets a bad rap a lot, but they did some interesting things with camera angles and with close ups that WWE never did. It was obviously just the different production style, but they were able to do some cool things that kind of gave you a different view of matches than you would have in WWF. And I grew up a WWF fan. I didn't really watch much WCW until the late 90s. So all my early WCW watching is going back and looking. So I guess it's just for somebody who grew up watching it, it's not different. But for me, it's a different way of watching, and I think that stuff is neat. The differences between the two are neat to see.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that too. I thought it made the match seem like a huge event.
So, Ross tries to kind of give Luger a narrative here, talking about his 1988 challenges. He mentions the Baltimore Great American Bash, which you mentioned with Flair. He doesn't specifically get into it, but with where Luger had Flair up in the torture rack, but then Luger had the trickle of blood, and they stopped the match because of that. He seems to forget about Starrcade '88, their rematch where Luger almost wins it again, but then there's the flu or Luger collapses when he gets him in the torture rack, and Flair pins him with his feet on the ropes. But anyway, so basically, you know, it's like, okay, the idea of Luger was a fan favorite at the time, and then decided to go his own way, and now he's back, you know, in this challenge. Flair gets a wrist lock to start. Luger tosses him down. Flair gets into it with Nick Patrick a bit. Not the full tilt thing that he would do with Tommy Young, but just a little bit of frustration. Luger decides that he wants a test of strength. And Flair eventually does. It's funny to watch Flair sort of slowly like tilt his hand, like wanting to get the knuckle lock at least a little bit lower, so he would negate Luger's height advantage. And to see sort of, you can tell Flair doesn't want to do it, but because he has that sense of pride, he will do it. And Ross even puts that over in the commentary.
Yeah, I think they were table setting at this point, and they started with a theme that really continued throughout the match, which was that this is all about Ric Flair being wily and Lex Luger being strong. And so it was, Luger was just overpowering Flair at every turn, and Flair was trying to outsmart him.
Absolutely.
Sometimes legally, sometimes illegally. He was just, it was all hands on deck.
Sure,
But
absolutely.
that's how he was working the match. And I think that this sequence was just kind of a way to establish that, because they were going to stick with that for the whole match.
Flair, that goes as you'd expect. Then Luger hits Flair at full speed on a charge off the ropes. Another in-ring exchange ends with Luger clothesline out of the corner. Flair decides he at that point he wants to bail. He and Woman go up to the ramp, and then Luger sends him back in. Flair is able to drop Lex's neck on the ropes, but it doesn't have any effect. And then Lex hits a press slam. It's at this point that Terry Funk has a nice bit of commentary where Jim Ross talks about how smart Luger is. He had like a 3.78 GPA in college, and that was kind of one talking point they would always have with Luger, is that he's just really a smart guy. And then Terry Funk wonder if Luger has any common sense, which I do kind of think like almost like is a decent encapsulation of Lex Luger as a character, if not as a performer.
Sure. Sure, I think so too. And, you know, it's funny that Jim Ross mentioned that grade point average probably on every pay-per-view for 3 years. So it's just, I laugh now. I mean, I think it's a cool thing to mention in the context of the story, so I don't mean to downplay that. I just, sure. I laugh anytime someone mentions it now, because a few of us, when we were watching this match and some other matches surrounding this time at ProWrestlingOnly.com, made a drinking game, and one of the things was take a shot every time that Jim Ross mentions Lex Luger's GPA.
I hope you didn't have too many of the football references, because I think people would be dying if that were
the
case.
And also talking about the football references, talking about Stan Lane's educated feet.
There you go.
Bobby Eaton, a native of Huntsville, Alabama, and the former Cincinnati Bengal, like all of those things were part of it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Flair is back. He gets back in, he begs off, and then gets that short kick to the ribs. But however, Luger recovers with another press slam, gets a pin attempt, but Flair is in the ropes. A big chop by Flair does nothing. Lex gets another press slam, then locks a bear hug, which puts Flair in agony. It's a nice looking bear hug too. He gets him low and has him kind of up on his shoulders to, you know, it's the bear hug, of course, is all about execution and all about how the opponent sells it. And this is done pretty well. In fact, Lex eventually puts Flair down, and we get a couple of near falls based on that. He's holding on to the bear hug, but he leans down, and we get a couple of near falls off of that. So
a few comments on this part of the match.
Sure.
First of all, I'm not a huge fan of the bear hug in general, but I love the bear hug as a pinning combination. I love it. Like, for some reason, that just always, like, it's one of my favorite things that I don't see enough of in wrestling. But anytime I see a bear hug slide into a pin attempt, I think that's awesome. But also, and this continues throughout the match, but you mentioned a few of the two counts. Ric Flair can time a kick out at the perfect millisecond, better than probably anyone in wrestling history, where you can do it at just the right moment to get the perfect crowd reaction.
Yeah.
He's amazing at that. And when you said that, it just reminded me of how, I mean, that was pretty early in the match, and that was a pretty good near fall.
Absolutely. Yeah. Obviously that does stand out for Flair, but there were three like excellent ones in this match. And that's certainly something I think of, you know, for Flair, but I don't know if I've, I think they were unusually good even for Flair.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Ross mentions that this would be, if Luger wins this match, this would be the first time anyone has ever held the United States and world titles at the same time. And I forgot to check, but other than Goldberg, I'm not sure anyone ever did that.
I think he's the only one. Yeah. I'm pretty sure you're right about that.
Yeah. Which is, you know, that's a nice thing for Goldberg. I don't think it's going to happen in WWE. So,
you know what? Actually, Luger did the next year in the Great American Bash.
He
was the U.S. champion.
He was the U.S. champion. Okay, when he won it and turned heel from Wyndham.
Right.
Well, that one doesn't count.
We don't need to remember Bash 91.
No. So Flair gets a thumb to the eye to stop the momentum, which definitely is a tactic he will return to in this match. Luger gets the 10 punches in the corner. Flair flops out of that. Luger plays to the crowd. He goes for a big clothesline, running clothesline, but Flair dodges and Luger falls all over the ropes. And I didn't think about it necessarily watching the match, but I do feel like Flair didn't rely on, like, I mean, he does the flop and he does one of the flips in the corner, but I feel like he didn't do a lot of the excessive repetition that his matches sometimes get into and kind of, like, relying on, like, those comedy spots.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, some of the stuff was there, but it wasn't the focus of the match at all.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he does a few, like, there's definitely a few, like, there's three or four thumb to the eyes and kick to the ribs. He kind of is able to sort of take the advantage on Luger the same way several times, and there's a number of Luger pressing Flair, but yeah, there's definitely less of that than in some of the Flair matches.
Also, I thought when Luger went over the top rope, that was a pretty nice little bump that
Oh
he
yeah.
took.
Yeah, I mean, Luger's really running hard here. Like, I feel like he's just, like, everything is, like, pretty much is full bore.
You know, this reminds me, there was a letter around this time, I think it was a few months after this, that someone wrote Dave Meltzer in the Wrestling Observer newsletter, where they asked him about the nicknames that he had for guys like the Anabolic Warrior and the Junk Food Dog. I don't know if you're aware, he would call the Ultimate Warrior and the Junkyard Dog those
Oh,
names
yeah.
constantly at the time in the Observer. Anyway, someone, I think it was Bruce Mitchell, actually, of the Pro Wrestling Torch, he wrote him a letter, not so much criticizing him for that, but still, I don't know. There were a lot of interesting points raised, and he did criticize him for it in some ways and didn't in others. But anyway, one point that Dave raised in response was he said, "There's a reason that I call the Ultimate Warrior these names, and there's a reason that I don't call Lex Luger these names." And then he said, "When Luger first started out, he was horrible. He couldn't work more than 30 seconds without blowing up. But he changed his workout routine, and he because he had a respect for, what it took to be a professional wrestler, and now he can go 30 minutes and cut a good pace and not have any problems." Where Warrior just he never made that transition, and so it implied kind of like a lack of respect for the craft.
Sure.
And so that's what that made me think of when Luger took that huge bump, and also that he's going hard, like you just said. He is someone that improved so much from the point he debuted in '87 in the company to this point.
Absolutely. Hey, I'm gonna let the dog out just real quick. So, 20 seconds.
Sure.
Okay. So we have at this point Flair smells blood. He sends Luger into the rail. Luger sort of staggers and stumbles some outside, selling the I think the pain of the fall and the confusion and so forth. They go back in for a minute and then Flair tosses him again. And then Flair has Woman distract Nick Patrick on the apron. Flair attacks Luger on the outside a bit, although he doesn't really cheat there. So maybe not the maybe didn't take advantage of that like he should have. But I'm not here to criticize the six-time world champion.
Well, I think my takeaway from that, because I had the same thought at first, my takeaway from that is that he wanted Luger outside so he can do more damage for a longer period of time. So Woman wasn't so much distracting him as she was stopping the count.
Ah, okay, there you go. I like it. Or even if it wasn't, not every plan works out perfectly. So,
That's true too, yeah.
we get a bit for a while where Luger is trying to regroup outside, trying to get back in, and then keeps getting knocked off the apron. This actually has done really well. Like, I feel like Luger, is kind of summoning that, fighting spirit, trying to get back in, and Flair keeps, preventing that from happening. I feel like the Flair, the crowd's, kind of in the idea of that. I thought that was, a simple thing, but a thing that's done real well, Then eventually we get Luger back in. Flair does a couple snap mare and knee to the head. Does it twice. The second time gets two, but Luger gets a very strong kick out of it. We get a chop and punch exchange that Lex wins. However, he misses a shoulder charge into the turnbuckle. Flair locks a hammer lock, uses the ropes to his advantage. Works on the arm for a while. Lex eventually fights out of it and gets a clothesline. However, Flair manages to continue to get the advantage through cheating. Even Woman gets in on the action. I think at one point he sort of slaps her, and then or she slaps him rather, and then like at another point just sort of like grabs his face, and you know,
Yes.
so she gets a little bit on it, and I like the reaction. Like, it's great when Nick Patrick turns toward it. He of course misses it, as he misses a lot of things in this match, and I love that the fans are like pointing at her and like, you know, she cheated, you know, punish her. You know, I love
Yes.
that the fans are so invested in the action of the match that you get that reaction.
And I love also how mean Flair was during this part of the match. He was so aggressive and mean-spirited. I mean, well, hearing you recap all that stuff and just remembering like that part of the match, to me, that's what a heel does right there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, and just like, and using the little things to get his advantage, and taking advantage of the rules. It's just small things, but it all adds up to, you know, to like, hey, this guy's a real jerk. I do not like him.
And I always like Ric Flair matches where he works the arm. It usually doesn't go anywhere. Like, it doesn't lead to something later. But Flair is so good at working the arm. It
Yeah.
just, like, all of his shots and the stuff he does just looks really good.
Yeah, he has a nice hammerlock, and yeah, it's one of his better. I mean, I don't know. I can't think of anything Flair did normally that didn't look good. But yeah, I agree that. But of course, it gives them a chance to bring up the Andersons and that tradition of the Horsemen working on over the arms and so forth. But Luger's also very good at, you know, fighting back and engaging the crowd, and you know, and getting those like mini hope spots, and you know, and being cut off, and you know, I'm impressed with his performance as well. He tries to punch out of that hammerlock, but Patrick ends up grabbing his arm, which gives Flair another chance to get a cheap kick to the ribs, which I thought that was thought that was really good. Flair tries a few pins. The feet are on the ropes each time, and Nick Patrick on the third or fourth one finally notices. Terry Funk calls it smart wrestling, whether it's right or wrong. And Luger is able to grab Flair by the throat and toss him into the corner. There's a Flair flip, and they both end up outside. The Flair chops are ineffective. Luger at this point, it shows great intensity. Flair begging off. He tries to cut him off again with the rib kick, which is a little bit more successful. We do end up though with a Luger sleeper. Luger or Flair eventually falls, but his feet end up on the ropes when Luger tries the pinfall. Luger then tries another sleeper, but Flair suplexes out of it. And I should mention, we're close to like 25 minutes into this match, and I don't think there's been a point in it in which the crowd is not super invested in what's going on.
Not at all. And later in the match, actually, it may have, or I don't think it had happened yet. It was something that it's only known because Dave Meltzer was at the show live and he mentioned it when he recapped the match. But there was a fight in the stands during this match, and people were so into the match that they didn't even turn to watch it.
Wow.
He said he had never seen that happen
Yeah.
before.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So Flair, he teases a suplex on the apron to the outside. Lex is able to reverse it. And then he grabs Flair's legs and pulls them toward the post. Flair like tries to escape it, but Lex grabs him and, you know, pulls him toward it, and then slams his knee into the post, which I really enjoyed that. The way Flair was tried to escape it, I thought was really cool, because a lot of guys just kind of go along with it a little bit. It was just a nice, you know, added thing. And Luger tries the figure four, but he clearly has not studied it. It does not go well. In fact, Ross even points out that he's not proficient at it. So.
Yeah, it's the one blemish on this match that I can't deny, sadly.
Flair hits a few chops, knocks Lex down with a charge, which I think was supposed to be a power slam, but they cover it well enough. But Flair does the charge again, and then Lex is able to get the power slam. There's the really, really close near fall on that one that a good portion of the crowd thought was actually a three. Flair chops him, then a charge fails. Lex flexes and intensely, and then go outside. However, Lex runs into the dreaded thumb to the eye. They're back in the ring, and Lex reverses a hip toss into a backslide. We get another great near fall. Woman at this point is begging to the Nature Boy, and Terry Funk has the classic line of, "Why don't the girls holler for me?"
Yes.
Hey,
I also just to talk about that backslide near fall.
Sure.
I have to comment on this because this is a criticism people throw at Ric Flair sometimes, and I think this is the reason why it's ridiculous. Something people often say about Flair is that his matches, especially his title changes, don't often have decisive finishes. Like they'll have a roll up or an inside cradle or, you know, like it's not a strong finish to the match.
Sure.
I think the advantage to that is that his near falls always have so much heat in matches like this. The backslide was a match that had cost him the world title in the past. That's how Kerry Von Erich beat him back in 1984. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that was, I'm not saying that was in people's minds in the crowd when they were watching this, but the idea that he could lose on roll-ups and, you know, that it wouldn't always have to be a finishing move.
Sure.
I think it gave these falls so much heat that they wouldn't have had otherwise.
Or that power slam, exactly. Yeah, I really advocate for the idea of, like, kind of getting away from the finisher as, you know, or even, like, a match has to end after a certain sequence, after a certain, you know, series of buttons are pressed. You know, I think it's cool sometimes, you know, obviously rarely, but I think it's cool sometimes if a big match goes 5 minutes, you know, and, you know, I just think that there is something neat about having as much variety in the types of finishes that you can have, just to, you know, get people to care about more than just, you know, than just the near falls and the finish.
Yeah, I like it more when wrestlers have a lot of signature spots,
right?
And all of them are moves that could potentially end a match instead of like one established finisher.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's nice to have like kind of two or three options at the very least. And like I said, you know, and to be able to buy into, okay, this small package could do it, or this backslide could do it, or things like that. And that is, that's kind of like a bag of tricks that could be used. And, you know, at least in WWE, is modern WWE doesn't seem to be used, you know, quite that often.
At least WWE has the right world champion to advocate for that change.
That's true.
Because he loves those finishes, so yeah. Maybe he'll bring them back.
Yeah, yeah. We can only hope. Flair gets a few chops. He knocks Lex down with a charge. Does it again, but then we have... I'm sorry. I already mentioned that. The power slam. After Funk talks about why the girls don't holler for him, Flair lands an axe handle off the top for a two. So Flair off the top, it worked. A double arm suplex for two. And Ross talking about how Flair just cannot hold this awesome athlete down. Flair jumps on Lex's back with a sleeper. Luger goes down to his knees, but after two arm drops, he fights back up, although noticeably slower than he had been fighting back up before, which the commentators mentioned, yeah. You know, which I kind of think is a nice way of, like, you know, because there's moments in which, of course, Luger kind of shrugs off Flair's stuff without, you know, giving much thought to it, some of the chops and some other things like that. So it's kind of nice when we're deeper into the match that that doesn't happen as easily for him.
Yeah, and I think it puts over Flair's offense as cumulative, kind of.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it doesn't have immediate impact, but you can shake off the chops all you want. Eventually, you do enough of them and they are going to hurt you. But also, I thought that the sleeper hold was such an awesome camera visual because Luger, like it put over Luger's body. I thought that was really cool because Flair is making Luger carry him while he has the sleeper applied.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you make a guy look like $1 million.
Absolutely.
Right there. Well, you're beating him up, but you're putting him over at the same time.
Right. Yeah. That's absolutely right. So Flair gets a roll up for two, but Lex is able to pop out, hit a clothesline for two, but then misses his big running elbow drop. Flair then hits a knee breaker and does his usual targeting the knee offense, including jumping on his knee on the ropes and such. Gets the figure four. Rick holds on to the top rope with Nick Patrick missing. He did miss a lot of things during this match. Couple of near falls there. Then Sting runs out, walks out to cheer Lex on. We see Lex flexing and eventually able to turn Flair over. They end up in the ropes with Flair actually being up, so he locks on that figure four for an extra 4 seconds before he has to actually break out of it. And
Flair is not giving anything in this match. I love that. Love that.
So Lex is draped on the ropes. And then Sting, you know, yells at him to, you know, go out there and beat Rick. You know, he's got to summon up the energy. Lex gets an adrenaline rush. Flair bails out. Lex chases after him. And then Flair, like he's been doing throughout the match, tries to, you know, get that cheap shot and tosses him into the rail. But Lex feels no pain. Back in the ring, Luda gets another press slam. He does get the poke in the eye, but Flair catches him, or Luger catches Flair off the top and sends him off the top rope down. He calls for the rack, gets a series of clotheslines, a third of which sends Flair over the top. Lex then suplexes him back in 4-2, another very close near fall with Ross talking about how close can it get. We get a power slam. Lex calls for the rack again, although oddly decides to go for the near fall. Now, in the interview before the match, he talked about power slam, torture rack. Power slam, torture rack. That was kind of, you know, his whole game plan. So a little odd that he didn't do that. But, you know, he may be a little tired here.
And those, I mean, we talked about the near falls before, but by this point in the match, those near falls are insane.
Yes.
because they're so precise.
Yeah.
It's just how good, I can't say enough for how good those two counts are.
They really are.
Flowing.
And we're not like in an era where like the two, you know, the near falls, you know, kind of have been done to death. I mean, not that they didn't happen in matches and in big matches, but it's, you know, it didn't feel like it was like a trick that, you know, you use to try to add false drama to a match. I mean, completely fit in with what they were trying to do.
It's the difference between getting a pop off of a near fall because someone kicked out of something that people don't normally kick out of, and getting a pop off of a near fall because of the timing of it. That's what I think is the difference.
That's a very good way of putting it.
And because it's just that split second difference where, like, had Flair done it slightly off, it wouldn't have gotten the same reaction. That's what I love about those.
Mm-hmm. So woman tries to interfere. I think she tries to slap Lex. Lex grabs her by the wrist, sort of pulls her up and tells her to slap him. She slaps him, but it has no effect. Flair knees Luger in the back, which sort of knocks woman off of the apron and also hurts Nick Patrick. Luger gets the 10 punches in the corner, throws Flair into the rope, another Flair flip. Luger he comes off the top with a clothesline, goes for the pin, but there's no ref. Then Lex hits a superplex, and there is no ref to count. Ole and Arn Anderson run in while Luger puts Flair in the torture rack. Jim Ross is screaming, Ric Flair is a beaten man. Nick Patrick is revived. Instead of going after Luger, though, the Andersons decide to gang up on Sting. So Luger sees what happens. He lets Ric Flair go. He goes down and he saves Sting. And then sort of both Andersons sort of hold Luger, kind of prevent him from, you know, at least slowing him down from getting back into the ring, while Jim Ross here is just absolutely just, you know, like screaming, get back in the ring, Lex. I mean, really, really in a very good way, adding to the intensity of this moment. And then Luger loses the match by counter. He's unable to get in time. And once he's able to get back in, Arn hits him with the DDT. The Andersons and Flair gang attack for just a little while. And then the Steiners come in and run off the Horsemen. And then they sort of stand tall in the ring. And Terry Funk talks about how, you know, Luger had compassion for another man and, you know, gave up his chance at winning the world title. But, you know, you on paper, you look at this match and you look at, like, you know, a 38-minute match that ends in a count out, and you think, like, oh, wow, that's a really cheap way of getting out of it. But the way it was done, I think, was very good.
The last 10 minutes of that match are quite the roller coaster, aren't they? I mean, that was, like, if you want to talk about emotion and a finishing stretch, that was pretty impressive. I think it's up there with a lot of the WrestleMania epics, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I thought it was fantastic, too. In the finish, it was both bad and brilliant at the same time, if that makes any sense. I mean, yes, there is the idea that you're going to invest nearly 40 minutes in a match and then get a count out finish. So I can understand people who don't like that. But in terms of, okay, Sting isn't coming back anytime soon. We have to make Luger our top babyface for now. He was our top heel less than 3 weeks ago. Like, and he was actually a very over top heel. So we have to do something major. And I thought it was done exceptionally well.
Yeah. There's a little bit of awkwardness of Sting, like, you know, he's obviously out there on crutches, and he can't do very much, you know, and obviously the Horsemen have to kind of be careful with him, you know, not to actually hurt him, but, you know.
And Flair spinning on him was awesome, too.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
You know, Sting can't do anything, and Flair's just leaning over and spinning on him, and it was just fantastic.
Yeah. So yeah, this was is a really great match, a really good performance. I mean, I do like Luger's 88 matches with Flair, particularly the Starrcade 88 match, but I do think this one definitely hits another level.
And I think it's because Luger grew a lot as a performer between Starrcade 88. Like, Starrcade 88 seemed to be around the time that he was really putting it together, I think, because his stamina was a lot better than it was at the Great American Bash, you know, a few months before that, to the point where even the announcers talked about how much he had trimmed down and gotten in shape so he could go that long. But I think by this point he was really putting the pieces together and to become a really good wrestler.
Yeah, absolutely. And okay, there are going to be some people here who are going to hear, like, okay, Lex Luger at one point was really good and are going to say, like, that is a ridiculous idea. What are some of the standout performances? You know, like, not necessarily, obviously, you know, you can expect Luger to be carried, so to speak, by Flair or by whomever. But what are some standout performances you think that Luger had kind of in that, you know, 88 through 91 time that, you know, like, you wouldn't on paper expect to be very good, but actually turned out to be good?
I'll pick three. And two of them are on the WWE Network, so they should be easy for people to watch. The first one was a match that he had in 89 on TV against Kendall Windham, actually. And Luger just was – it was like this – it was only like a seven-minute match, but it was this really fast-paced, like, kind of like power move spot fest. It was really impressive. There was a spot where Luger did a lucha roll on the mat, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
And then there was even like, the finish was Kendall jumping off the top rope to do a crossbody and Luger catching him and turning him into a power slam, and it just looked great. So that's, like, a match. I mean, it's not a great match, but it's a really fun, short match that shows a different side of Luger. Another match, and this one is on the network, is Luger versus Tommy Rich at Clash of the Champions 8. I think that's a really good match to showcase what Luger brought to the table at that point. Tommy Rich was not, I mean, I always liked Tommy Rich, actually. He's a very underrated wrestler, I think. But that run is kind of, I mean, it has its good moments and it has its okay moments, but that's the highlight of Tommy Rich's career, probably from that point on, as far as an in-ring performance. And Luger, I thought, was kind of the glue to that match. The final one, I would say, is Luger against Danny Spivey at WrestleMania 91, and that's also on the network. And if you want to see Luger directing traffic, not being carried, but actually directing a match with a lesser opponent, that's the match to watch. Because Luger just pulls out this miracle performance out of nowhere that I think even people like me who give him credit for being good, like it even surprised me just how good it was. So that would be another one that I would recommend people check out.
Yeah, another one that I really think is strong is the match against Brian Pillman at Halloween Havoc 89. And Pillman's obviously a very good performer, even in his early days, so maybe that one's not quite the same kind of example, but I do think that's another one where I think that's not long after Luger turned heel, and he's just really strong there, and you know, he really does a lot to kind of make you think that Pillman has a chance to win that match, and I think there's some really good stuff at that one as well.
Yeah, and I love the finish of that, just because I love the stun gun as a move. Like, I would love for someone to bring that back, actually. But that was a great finish, too.
Yeah, DiBiase always did that one well, too.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, that's a nice, that's a great, like, completely understand, like, just, not like a fluke exactly, but it's just like, oh, you got caught on that. It's completely understandable that you could get caught by that and lose the match, and you don't lose any face yet. It makes your opponent, it makes the heel who'd usually hit it seem smart and, you know, crafty for doing it.
Yeah, because, I mean, literally everything can be going your way and then bam, you lost the match. I mean, that's what I like about that move.
Yeah. All right, so anything else you want to talk about before we get to the Twitter questions?
No, let's go.
All right, let us go. Let's see. Brad W at Brad 21126. Where does this match rank among Lex's best overall and in their feud specifically?
I think it's the best match of the feud and the best match of his career. Would you agree with that?
Definitely the best match of his their feud. I can't think of a better match that he had. I mean, as far as just like kind of like a big epic, you know, performance, I can't think of one that he had that was stronger. I would say it's off the top of my head, I would say it's the best match I've ever seen him in anyway.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a star rating guy, if anyone listening is a star rating guy, I'd probably go 4 3/4 on this.
Okay. I'm not a star rating guy, but I don't have any objections to that. Monsoon Classic at Monsoon_Classic. How would both of you rank Luger among the other strongman opponents Flair had?
I guess, I mean, I think Luger was better than Nikita Koloff.
Yeah.
And I think Nikita was pretty cool. Nikita was almost so cool that he didn't have to be good in the ring. But I still think Luger was a better all-around performer than Nikita. I wouldn't really consider Sting a strongman. I don't know if I would put him in that same category.
Yeah, he does some of the kind of the same stuff that a strongman would do, but he's he jumps around more and, you know, and it does more. He kind of treads that line a little bit.
Yeah, but I would say that Luger is a better opponent for Flair than Sting. And that may seem controversial to some people just because the Flair Sting rivalry is so remembered. But I don't think that if you look at this match, Starrcade 88, Clash 12, which is also on the WWE Network, I don't think that Flair and Sting had any three matches that touched those three.
Yeah, I mean, you could maybe argue there's obviously the first Clash, the Sting Flair match, you know, which I do think is very good, but I think it's more of like I think as a match, it's not as good as a like performance to make Sting look like a contender, which I mean, obviously was the goal of the match, so it worked on that level, but it's not like quite as enjoyable of a watch. kind of outside of that context.
I think it's more of a fitting match than it is a great match. And it's a very fitting match, but yeah.
So
and Kerry Von Erich, I guess, would be the another guy that would be kind of in the same category.
Yeah.
That's a tough one because Ric Flair and Kerry Von Erich had great chemistry. I would say that him and Luger are neck and neck as far as their chemistry with Flair. Kerry might have a slighter edge because I think Kerry was a better all-around wrestler. But as far as the output, like the end result, as far as how good the matches were, they're probably neck and neck.
Yeah, and also that was kind of a different point in Flair's career where, I mean, obviously Flair was a great performer in 88 through 92, but, you know, I don't know, I think 84, 85, 86, I mean, I think you could argue Flair might have even been a bit of a better performer than he was later. Athletically, he's younger, obviously, so.
Yeah, the early 80s Flair, like, in the late 80s, like, Flair is still great, but he's also, he has changed his style a lot. In the early 80s, Ric Flair is a matte guy. He's doing a lot more moves. Like, he's a very athletic guy at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Time limit draw at the TLD podcast. Does Healthy Sting get the belt here or only a DQ? Do you think they would have had, because the setup for Sting Flair obviously, you know, like, wasn't, you know, it only happened a few weeks earlier, so do you think they would have given Sting the title that quickly, or do you think that they would have, I mean, it's obviously like completely NWA WCW to make it a chase rather than to give it to Sting right away, but at the same time, if you're transitioning to Sting, you know, do you try to get him as hot as possible?
The plan was to do it, and I think the reason they wanted to do it so quickly is because they wanted to beat the WWF to the punch with the Ultimate Warrior, because they were really convinced in that they of the two, they had the right guy.
Yeah, which, you know, on paper, you would think that would be the truth, you know? I mean, the only thing that I'll say about Warrior as a performer is that he had an odd penchant for rising to the occasion in the big moment.
Yes.
Which is something that Sting didn't always do for whatever reason. I think Sting was obviously a much better performer overall and had some great matches in big moments. But, I don't know. I kind of think for whatever reason, and maybe that's just a difference between WWE and WCW too. But
I think we saw the best from Sting when he was challenged. When he had someone who was going to make him work a different type of match and make him think about things. Because I think guys like Vader and Cactus Jack really got a lot out of Sting because they were unlike any of his other opponents.
Yeah, that's a good point. And then Flair and Sting kind of got to a level and never got past that level. You know, I mean, their first match is probably their best match, at least that I've seen. So.
And, you know, something else interesting about the plans at the time, like at one time, and this was in the Torch, I think, around this time, I don't remember if it was ever in the Observer or not, but there was a plan to once again, for the third year in a row, run a Clash of the Champions special head-to-head with WrestleMania.
Hmm.
And I think at that point, the plan was still to do Flair Sting, but as a babyface match where Flair would somehow retain, because they were wanting to set up Flair defending against Luger at the Clash, where he would drop the title on free TV to a heel Luger in a huge moment. And it was just, and it's not so much, I think they batted around, that might've just been an idea that was thrown out more than it was like a planned vision.
Sure.
Because I think that they really, I mean, there was a lot of debate among people in power in the company at the time over, you know, should we run with Sting or should we run with Luger? And Sting was easier to work with as a person. And so he ended up winning out in the end, even though, you know, Luger was probably a little bit more established as a star at that point.
Sure. David A. Smith at D. Smith Images had just kind of a really interesting alternative scenario to turning Luger at this point. And I don't know if it would have been practical because I'm not sure he would have been available. But I'm just going to explain it, and we'll talk about it because I think it's a fun what if, even if it wasn't completely realistic. But his idea of Sting should have been confronted by Flair, who would have demanded to win the match by forfeit. And then Sting says he's able to give his spot to a wrestler of his choice. Flair is cocky about it, but asks who. And then Sting says, the one man who took me to the limit. The lights go out, they come back on, and the great Muta is in the ring and Miss Flair and disposes the rest of the horsemen, and then has a standoff with Sting, which is kind of a will-they-won't-they moment. Sting extends his hand, Muta waits a moment, and they shake hands, and the crowd goes wild, and Muta, you know, and Muta is the challenger, at least, I guess, for the one show.
I am 100% sold on that. I think that would have been fantastic and probably would have had a lot of excitement because, I mean, it clashed 10 less than 3 weeks before the show. Because the Horsemen turned on the same show, the crowd babyfaced the Great Muta, and he got a huge reaction that night. But I do think, you know, eventually they were going to have to turn the Great Muta babyface if he stuck around. Practically, I don't know that that would have worked, only because New Japan was ready to get him back.
Right.
Because they had plans for him. So his days were a little bit numbered there, but yeah, I think had they had access to Muta, that would have been a far, far better plan than what they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Dylan Hales at Dylan Waco. How bad did the 1990 face turn and failure to win the title hurt Luger going forward as a star in wrestling? Would it be fair to say that Sting being positioned the way he was hurt Luger? Would Luger have been a better drawing champ ace than Sting ended up being?
In my opinion, yes. I think, I don't know that the face turn hurt him as much as not beating Ric Flair after doing such a long chase. Because, I mean, he really basically chased him for 2 years. Right. And it was almost, I mean, you see that happen a lot in the Japanese promotions, but you don't see that happen too much in the American promotions where you have somebody going after the title and a rivalry lasting that long. So it was really kind of unique in that regard. But yeah, I think not beating Ric Flair is the bigger issue. He should have stayed a heel for sure. I think that's, he had way more potential as a heel than as a babyface at this point. But I think just the house show numbers after Wrestle War show that they could have still salvaged something out of it if they gave Luger his moment. Now, at the Great American Bash, something that I always thought was interesting is that when Sting wins the title and all the babyfaces come out to celebrate with him, Luger did not come out to celebrate. And I don't know this, but I always suspected that that was a promotional decision because they had positioned Luger as a top babyface during Sting's absence, and they didn't want the moment. They didn't want Sting to look like he was sharing the stage with Luger at that moment. They wanted it to be Sting's moment, and that's just my theory. I can understand the logic behind that, but to me, Luger's absence kind of stood out.
Yeah, that definitely. I had forgotten that. That is interesting. Yeah, I think that would be kind of a thing. I mean, like, you could kind of even play that into like a story of like, hey, Lex, why didn't you come out to celebrate? And tie that into something later. But yeah. But yeah, that definitely, given that their relationship is kind of part of it, ended up being part of that story. That is sort of an odd thing.
I think the exact moment that Flair Luger stopped meaning anything as a rivalry was at Capital Combat. There are good non-finishes, which is what this match had at Wrestle War, and then there are terrible non-finishes, which is what that match was. It's had a cage match that ends with a DQ because of interference.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
It's pretty inexcusable. You know, the original plan for that match, because they wanted to give Luger a win, they had actually considered doing a non-title hair versus hair match and having Luger win and Flair get his head shaved.
Huh.
But Flair didn't want to cut his hair. And finally, you know, later in the year, Flair agreed to finally cut his hair.
Right.
And be the Black Scorpion. But yeah, at one time they were going to do Flair versus Luger, hair versus hair in a cage.
Yeah,
so
that would have been at least kind of something. Yeah, I do feel like, I definitely feel like, I remember, you know, when I was a fan, you know, like around 88 and they were doing the first Luger-Flair feud, I always kind of felt like, you know, like, having been a WWF fan for a few years and I read magazines. So I was, you know, kind of aware of what, you know, NWA was doing, WCW was doing and knew that, you know, I knew Luger and I knew, Sting and Road Warriors and Flair and all those guys, even if I rarely watched it, but like, I always like, I knew the Luger Flair story and knew Luger was chasing Flair and figured, okay, well, Luger's going to obviously win the title at Starrcade 88 because Luger is their the next Hogan. That's what they're trying to do. That I was a 10-year-old at the time. That was just my mentality. Of course, that's what they'll do because that's what you do in wrestling, because that's what I was used to the idea. So, and I understand now, years later, the reasons why that didn't happen, kind of the politics behind it. But at the time, I'm just like, well, what are they thinking? It's like why wouldn't you want, like I kind of grew up with like thinking like wrestling, the mentality for me is like, it's like a comic book where serial where the good guys win most of the time. And, but WCW was still kind of run in the old territorial mentality where, the guys are chasing, the good guys are normally chasing the heel for a long time before you kind of pay off on that thing. And of course for Luger, it never really came. I think it hurt him. I do like, there's always sort of the talk that Sting's injury and then not winning the title until a few months, until June hurt him. But I don't know. That was 4 months. I just have a hard time believing that really made that much of like a long-term impact in Sting's career, where I can see like, okay, another turn and another failure to win when he was on top, even though, like you said, the Luger Flair, after the turn, the Luger Flair, house shows at least did good business. So there's some, there's indications of positives there that didn't hurt Luger as much as you might think. But I do think you're right. Like the failure to win it in the end, and then when he does win it, like he wins it a year later with Flair gone in like the cheapest way possible.
Yeah. I can't really disagree with any of that. I think to me, I think Luger needed to win the title and have a long run with it. And they sort of gave him that in 91, but even in 91, he won the title and he still didn't beat Ric Flair, and at that point it was extenuating circumstances because they actually planned for it. But it really is. Luger got a choker label from that. And then he goes to the WWF, and Vince McMahon, I don't think followed WCW closely enough to know that, okay, I'm pushing this guy and he has a choker label. So, of course, in his first big title match, he wins by count out, and it just continued that same choker label that Luger already had from another promotion. I think had someone clued Vince in about that, he might not have made that decision.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I do always wonder, like, how much, like, what other wrestling has Vince seen? Like, obviously, there's so much WWF, and that's obviously his focus, and he probably hasn't seen that much, But yeah, it's always like a wonder, like, does Vince like know anything about any other kind of wrestling at all?
Well, I know that, it was even in the Observer at the time that Vince, or not even Vince specifically, I guess it was more the WWF, that's how it was reported, couldn't believe that they actually did a count out finish in a main event on pay-per-view. Like, they were blown away that they would do anything like that. And I think at one time they had toyed with the idea of doing Hogan Warrior with a bunch of heels running in and beating them both up and then them running them off and then sharing the spotlight. And then after they saw that finish, they said, no way, we're giving them a winner and a loser. So that was in the Observer at the time. I don't know how
that's
much
interesting
validity there is to that.
But. Yeah, because obviously this is just a month before WrestleMania 6.
Yeah.
Of course, eventually WWF did do the Hogan Sid finish. I guess it's a DQ. Well, it was like Papa Shango was late, so Sid kicked out of the leg drop, and then they do a DQ.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I guess luckily they had Warrior out there to run out, or else that would be like remembered as like one of like the most like terrible finishes ever.
Yes.
I mean, the match is already pretty bad, but, So. So I guess it sounded like a better idea to them a few years later. Let's see. I think we have one other question. Now, from Eric Darcy at I Am Darcy. I think he's of the opinion – he is less of opinion of Luger than we do, but we'll just go ahead and see. If Luger was able to improve on his wrestling abilities, what could have come of his career? And I guess I'll rephrase it more of like, hey, let's say Luger had come to WWF and had been like as strong and as motivated and as focused as he showed in his early NWA, WCW career. Like how, do you think he'd have made a better go of it in his later career and been even more successful, or was it just was the way he was booked always going to kind of limit him, even though, he did have some success?
I think it depends on the gimmick you would get. I think the narcissist didn't quite fit in, although it was a better fit than Made in the USA. Whereas Made in the USA really didn't fit in because Luger, to me, was a very natural heel. He could be a good baby face at times too, but I mean, had Vince brought him in as the total package Lex Luger, I actually think he would have been very successful, especially if he had the same drive that he had in years prior.
Sure. He was probably a better working baby face, but promo wise, he probably wouldn't have been, he wasn't really ever, particularly strong as a baby face. He just never really kind of came off as like that sympathetic or that engaging in interviews. That was kind of one of, that's always kind of been the, I think, the weakest point of him for me.
Definitely. And Luger did pretty, they weren't great heel promos, but he did pretty solid ones. And I mean, they seemed real or natural, I guess is a better word, if nothing else.
Yeah, he could come off as aloof, I guess, was that was kind of like a, maybe that was just sort of a natural thing for him, but that sort of worked for him.
I just have to say this while we're talking about Luger and Sting. I know you weren't watching WCW regularly in 94 because I asked you that earlier. Were you in 96 prior to the NWO?
I was watching a little bit more, but not like super regularly.
The reason I mention that is because Sting and Luger were a tag team at that time, but they were doing this weird thing with them that I really think was a parody of their careers up until that point. Luger would turn on, Luger was a babyface when Sting was looking, and a heel when he wasn't looking.
Right.
And he would and find some way to accidentally turn on Sting almost every week. And then Sting would give him the benefit of the doubt. And then the next week they would be teaming again. And then it would happen again over and over for like 6 months. And I always thought that they were making fun of Luger having a split personality and turning so much. And they were making fun of Sting being way too trusting. So I always saw that as this whole like parody to make fun of them both.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, that was always kind of, that was a bizarre story, and they kind of ended up sort of just dropping it once the NWO showed up. But yeah, that was, yeah, that, it sort of the way that Luger was booked by WCW when he came back pre NWO was sort of strange in retrospect too.
Yeah, well, I think supposedly, like, their only plans for him was because he had the name and it would
Yeah,
help
because
establish Nitro.
Bischoff didn't have a high opinion of him, right?
Yeah, and they just wanted him to do a clean job to Hogan, and then they really didn't have any ideas for him after that.
That's funny.
But that, and then I guess they decided to end up doing more with him. I never bought that Bischoff didn't have a high opinion of him. I always thought that was Bischoff trying to make himself look better in retrospect because they pushed Luger to the world title.
Yeah.
He was the top babyface in Sting's absence. So I think that they thought more of him than Bischoff likes to let us think they thought of him now.
Yeah, that's reasonable. I think there's a good chance that's true. Oh, wait a minute. Are you suggesting that Eric Bischoff would not can be completely honest with us?
Yeah. I was going to say, wait, I was just thinking the same thing. Eric Bischoff, why? No way.
I know. Shocking. Cool. Well, those are our Twitter questions. If there's nothing else that you have about this particularly, would you is there obviously tell everyone I talked a little bit about, but tell everyone about pro wrestling only and anything else that you would like to talk about?
Yes. You can register to post at Pro Wrestling Only by going to www.prowrestlingonly.com. And let me clarify. That's the website for the board. There is a registration feature there. It's kind of inconsistent, so I would encourage you, if you want to expedite the process, to send an email to pwomembership@gmail.com. send us what you want your username to be, and we'll set up your account for you and then get back in touch with you a lot faster than if you go through the registration process on the board. I encourage anyone who isn't sure if they want to participate or not or get registered to just look around the board and see what we're talking about. I think you'll find that it's a lot different than a lot of message boards around the internet, and I mean that in a good way. So I hope you'll give us a try, or at least read us and, you know, follow me on Twitter. You can find me at ProRes, WRES only. And right now I'm recapping the 90s in pretty extensive detail. I'm up to January of 1991. And the reason I'm doing that is because I'm working on an ebook that will be centered around the top 500 matches of the decade, not just in America, but all over the world. And so as I'm collecting my thoughts on that, and as I'm working on it, I'm, you know, tweeting about things and linking to things on YouTube. So hope that you'll like that. That book will be an ebook that will probably come out in February or March of next year. And, you know, stick with me on Twitter and go to prowrestlingonly.com, and we'll keep you updated on anything regarding that.
And I'd like to second, Pro Wrestling Only, it's a great site. Even if you're not much into posting, it's just a great place to, so much good content, so much good discussions about current wrestling and history that you'll find yourself, hours of, you can spend hours just, digging in there and finding excellent, interesting discussion and good content. So I advise everyone to check it out. And also, Charles is a great follow on Twitter. I recommend that as well. And obviously, everyone who is listening probably knows that you can follow me at WrestleSpective on Twitter, also on Facebook. And would appreciate anyone who listens to the podcast and is a fan to check out iTunes and Stitcher and leave ratings and reviews. And of course, let your friends know about WrestleSpective. We are always trying to get more people to listen to the podcast. We have a really great audience. A lot of people who who ask questions and who seem interested in the podcast and having some really good discussion about pro wrestling, which is what we're all about here. So I appreciate everyone who asks questions and who listens and who gives feedback, and more of it is always good. So those are the, like I said, Twitter is the best place, but anywhere you want to send me feedback, I definitely appreciate it. So Charles, thank you so much for being on the show. I think this is a really good discussion.
Yeah, thank you, Jason. I appreciate it.
No problem. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll be back again soon.